Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 95, where Miranda, Tom, and Greta are discussing the text On the Shop Floor, Two Studies of Workshop Organization and Output by Tom Lupton, originally published in 1963 by Pergamon Press. In part two, we will bring the questions that Lupton raises about the meaning and value of work to contemporary times. If you missed part one or to get the text, they are available at our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. We were in the middle of discussing the ethnographic approach, and I think it's interesting to note the differences between the two cases, the way that Lupton presents them. And I guess perhaps that's because his roles were different, the settings were different, so many factors were different in terms of, you know, how he, as a participant observer, was able to balance the time of being a participant and against that of being an observer. They're really nice, robust case studies, but they definitely read differently. What do we think about that?
I think it was really fascinating to see how the second study was quite populated by a lot of dialogues, probably even verbatim dialogues that recreated sort of the feel of the environment, but also were used as vignettes to sort of represent specific concepts. While actually what was happening in the first case study was more a clear in-depth knowledge of the workers, but a lot of sort of summary descriptions, very detailed descriptions, but not much dialogue. So perhaps the question is, what was actually Lupton doing differently in the two? Was it actually that he was less integrated and more integrated in certain dialogues rather than others? Or was he maybe more realistically busy working or not so busy in the other case? So that's sort of something quite interesting to observe.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm just thinking aloud, like, what could explain this? And one thing that stuck with me was how, in the first case, how the garment company decided in what unit to place him. And they placed him in the unit where there was only one man working in the company and the man was working in this unit. And they said, yeah, probably for lunch and dinner, you would like to hang out with a guy. That was kind of the assumption. And he writes then, you know, in the way he did his fieldwork, that indeed, you know, he was always having lunch and dinner with this guy. And he was also sharing a little bit of the mindset that this guy had and the opinions he had about the female workers, the women workers in the factory. So perhaps, you know, the way he got positioned in the organization and allocating him based upon his gender, that was different from the majority of the other workers in the first case, also prevented his access to more of the social life that these women had, which of course was, we saw very contrasting things happening in the second case. But I'm also thinking, you know, the way the work was structured in the first case was explicitly organized to prevent social interaction. And the technologies used in the second case necessitated social interaction. So perhaps there was just more opportunity for him to talk to people and write up some of the verbatim conversations that they had.
And I was also wondering, to what extent was the level of detail in the second case just the fact that it was the second case? Like, if he had done J's before Y, would he have had a little bit more experience under his belt to say, okay, I know what I think serves the study really well from the level of interaction I had at J's. How can I apply that at Y? And maybe even potentially have influenced how he negotiated where he was going to be in the factory. You know, we don't really know. But it was very clear that, the two studies read so differently because of it. But I don't think that in any way, you know, should diminish the quality of the outcome. But I think it is something that is worth mentioning for, you know, just the process of conducting ethnographies, that, you know, one's role in the organization is going to greatly influence the way that the study proceeds and what how you discuss it, how you present it.
Yeah, definitely. And in my experience, you know, you can approach doing ethnographic fieldwork in different ways. Like, I always negotiated access to do ethnography as being an independent researcher. So I was present on the work floor. I was embedded in teams, but I did not take on a role as the other team members had. Like, for instance, you know, when I was doing my platform ethnography, I was not a product manager or an engineer, or, but I was present in all the meetings that they had. I could access all the work materials that they were working on. So I could kind of take my own role. And in that sense, I did not have a stake in some of the company politics that were happening. And the same was in the Japanese multinational. But what you see here, like Lupton's approach to really get an insider perspective, is taking on that insider role. Like, he was actually sewing garments, and he learned how to sew garments. Yeah, the question is, like, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages of taking on a role in a company? Like, you know, as we discussed, it can give you access to certain groups of people, but you're also, as an ethnographer, you're putting yourself, unintentionally, you're being placed in a camp, because, you know, organizations are not neutral entities. They're like micro communities with issues at stake, conflicts happening that you're often unaware of. And by taking on like a job role and being part of this group, others will see you as an outsider or of the other camp. Yeah, I always, in my approach, I always prevented that from happening by just saying, like, you know, my role will be an independent researcher. I will be very much present, and I can go into any meeting that I want to, or that is relevant to the topic of my research, but I won't help conduct the actual work. But in that way, yeah, perhaps by doing that, I might also have prevented some access. I don't know.
Well, what also comes into play is what is the risk of being a participant observer on, you know, what risk is the company accepting? Because this is one of the things from Van Manen's study that we discussed quite a bit in episode 38, was that by being a participant observer, going through police training and joining the police force, here it is, an individual who knowingly goes into this as a temp and is going to leave after a year. And so then what real ability to enforce the law or to be able to serve as a police officer, a rookie police officer, what risk is the police force assuming on that basis? I don't think that there was anywhere near that level of risk assumed with Lupton's role in either of the particular companies, except for perhaps just being a speed bump in Y garments on occasion.
I think also the fact that in the Y's garment industry in company, we actually get a feel that he went through the hurdles and the challenges of the job, gives that further layer of richness as to sort of the fatigue and the effort that particular job takes on. So I think that's all to the benefit. And obviously the downside is that possibly a lot of the dialogues couldn't have been transcribed. But I do think it gives that extra understanding of the workers that can sort of put him on to really walk in their shoes for 6 months in this case. So I thought that was a really rich opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, what some ethnographers do is taking on different roles in the organization. And I'm thinking, for instance, about the work that Pat Betschke did in crime labs, where you had like different groups of technicians, some working on DNA, some working on different technologies. And so she spent time with each and every one of them over the period of her fieldwork. And that might perhaps also help you to get that really insider perspective, but not being positioned in kind of the power games, the political battles that are happening in organizations that might prevent you from having really good access to other occupational groups in the organization.
Okay. I think we've touched on, you know, the value that this study provides for research. I think there's a lot to discuss in terms of the broader implications of the study, especially in the modern times, because there's a lot of questions out there now that I think Lupton, because of the inside position that he had in these companies, the questions that he raises are really relevant to today. And the first one that just kind of pops into my mind that's a very active current conversation is, what is the meaning of work nowadays? What is the value of work? Who's setting the value? You know, here we are now about 2 years into the pandemic and certainly feeling the effects of the pandemic on the workplace, on the workforce, as we start to see, or as we've been seeing, people returning to the workplace. We've got kinds of issues about job satisfaction, destructive leadership, quiet quitting, all of these phenomena that in some way are not all that dissimilar to the tensions between workers and management in these two particular case studies. There's pressures upon management to keep a firm running and to try to do so, maximizing efficiency, whatever that means. You know, we're obviously, the work has changed from goods to a lot more services, but there's also a lot more individual autonomy. And then I'm also kind of bringing in, you know, when we talk about management control, the ultimate management control that we saw in episode 68, American Factory, our documentary, was the ability for the management to bring in other technologies that essentially exercise the control that they want on the workplace without having to deal with humans, to bring in robots or to bring in expatriate workforce who basically follows the desired organizational culture unflinchingly. And so then these tensions between worker and, you know, and worker management relations, they may have changed in character, but they haven't necessarily changed in nature in the past 60 years.
Yeah, these are all great points, Tom, and I fully agree with them. And, you know, one sentence that stood out for me in the conclusion on page 187 was about this incompatibility of controls. So it's incompatibility of the rashly contrived controls over workers' behavior, which are imposed by management, and the controls which are to be found in the spontaneous social relationships which workers enter into at work. You know, that really captured like the essence of Lupton's study. And to me, it also generates a conversation about the meaning of work and what do we as workers or as managers try to optimize for. And clearly, you know, there's a financial interest in optimizing for output, productivity. You know, these were all products, factories producing products. So we can also talk about, you know, services, but If you look at, you know, the meaning of work, what we see is that it's also a social context where social relationships are happening that also provide a lot of meaning for the workers performing the work, especially in the second case we saw that, but also in the first a little bit, like, you know, this person that every now and then got flown into the unit when somebody fell out and was always having lunch with one particular other member that they had like a deep friendship going on. Yeah, when I think about the pandemic, where the social component fell away or went digital for a lot of workers, you know, there was perhaps more opportunity for management to optimize for output, you know, and you don't have to drive to work. If you work at home and you're always at home, perhaps you can always work. You know, I'm saying some crazy things here now, but I feel like, you know, perhaps something got lost there in making managements and, you know, thinking about how we should do work, what work means to us. Maybe we lost something. Like today I read in the news that there's a massive numbers of people that take sick leave because of mental health issues. You know, thinking about how our work life has been in the past 2 years, perhaps more for white collar jobs than blue collar. And, you know, if you can work remote, it's also easier to stick to working remote and not going back to the workplace. And perhaps some of the unintended effects of that. So, yeah, those were some of the thoughts I had after reading this book.
Yeah, the remote work question kind of aligns with the white garment case to an extent, because you can imagine that, you know, physical proximity does not necessarily mean, you know, high social interaction. So we had there people who were essentially working independently, and the setting sort of channeled them. And the result there, because of all of the other factors that we mentioned in part one, was one where collective action was not taken. But the other thing is that there were pressures against individual action. So the, you know, as I believe I said in part one, he talked about how if somebody got upset, frustrated, whatever, with the situation, well, there was a mechanism, there was management pressures that were brought to bear. Now, where the character of the problem has changed is clearly the ability of the individual to protest, and now protest even more loudly, more publicly, get onto social media and make a big splash about something that they're complaining about in work, which now puts a completely different type of pressure on management, trying to keep a lid on things, but having to contend with the fallout of an individual's ability to voice their displeasure in a very, very public forum about things that might ordinarily in the past have been just handled quietly.
I think these are all very fascinating points. And I think something that I'd like to sort of add to the conversation is around this assumption of predictability. So we're talking a lot about controlling, optimizing efficiency, but this has to build on the idea that there is a level of predictability, that we know what's happening, we know in what timing and what costs and what other resources. One thing about the pandemic is also that we have experienced a very strong shock in terms of unpredictability. So, and this applies to a lot of industries more or less. If you think about it, every job, every industry that requires problem solving, a lot of the things that were observed in the Lupton's book, they sort of have to be tailored a little bit differently, because we're not talking anymore about pieces of garments that match or that need to be sewn together, or components of whatever product. So I think there's something really important to say about the nature of the industry, of the job, and of the environment more broadly speaking, around how can we control if we can control, because then if we can't control, obviously something else has to come in place and it has to be acknowledged as such. And I think that also starts to connect to conversations around workers being unhappy or being distressed. It's because a certain set of rules based on predictability are being applied, but actually they shouldn't be applied because it's not predictable. And I think that is a really strong point, that if this work were to continue, the ethnography work by Lupton today, it would have to factor in and probably bring out different types of findings.
Yeah, that's a great point. I would nuance it a little bit. Like, you know, there are still garment factories, but a lot of that manufacturing work we have outsourced and offshored. So perhaps those are not the context anymore that, you know, management scholars are interested in studying because they have been studied in the past. But definitely, you know, we had the episode on the American factory. Like, I think we should go back there to understand what is happening in these factories. That the workers aren't returning. Like, you know, I think it's across blue collar work. What we saw after the pandemic is that the workers that they were furloughed or they were fired by their employers, you know, these employers had a hard time finding workers, you know, to employ when we went back to, you know, the so-called new normal that we're living in today. When you look at airports, workers that are handling your luggage, you know, stewardesses that are checking you in, a lot of people working in just ensuring the safety at the airports, in the logistics, when we look at factories, I think across industries, we see a lot of shortage in labor markets, not just in the UK. We see it across countries, in the US, in Europe. And the question is, like, where are these workers? Like, that was a question I discussed last week with some of my colleagues. But also, why are they not returning? What is happening in, you know, these are mostly blue collar jobs that people don't want to perform them anymore? I think, yeah, we need more Lupton studies, I guess.
Well, you know, if I were to think about a number of the industries, because it isn't just blue collar, But when I think about a number of industries that have been in the press lately as facing significant shortages, I notice that a lot of them involve a lot of emotional labor. I'm reminded now of episode 35 that we did on the managed heart. Emotional labor, like when we think about food service workers and you know, restaurant workers, where there's direct interaction with customers and there's the potential for conflict. You know, when we're talking about mental health issues and stress, what I wonder about is, and I imagine that there are studies out there, I just am not aware of them, of just the extent to which people are externalizing the stresses that they're under on the basis of, you know, what the pandemic has done. And so then you have people who are leaving certain services in droves because they just can't handle dealing with angry customers. Or in the case of, say, public health, law enforcement, prison workers, and some of the others, where there's a sense that the job is not worth it. So that there's a change to the perception of the value of the work, of the value of the work compared to other alternatives. The commitment literature is generally kind of categorized what commits an individual to the workplace is like, you know, the sum of three forms. I like it here. I'm really obligated to be here. I have a sense of duty. And then the cost-benefit analysis is really favorable to my staying. And I think the cost-benefit analysis is the one that's kind of driving it, but it's across all three. People perhaps who were willing to put up with a favorable cost-benefit balance, despite the fact they may not like being in the job, they decided that, no, the cost-benefit's gone. I don't like it here. I don't feel an obligation. So it's like a total uncommitment. You know, I don't know where the state of research is into that. But it seems to me like if we're going to change the trajectory of people not wanting to go back to work, all three of those are very important fronts that have to be tackled, that have to be addressed. What makes the work valuable from not just an economic perspective, but also from an affective perspective and a duty perspective?
I completely agree with you, Tom. And, you know, we have like kind of three trends that are discussed in the media and in academia as well. First, the great resignation that was predicted to take place post-pandemic. Another one is surveys of workers, where the whole conversation around people not finding their jobs interesting anymore. And then the trend towards quiet quitting that is quite dominant in the UK media at the moment. It was an article in The Guardian, I believe, on this phenomenon and how people are minimizing their commitment to their jobs. All these, you know, debates that are happening in isolation in the media, they're touching upon, you know, what is the meaning of work? What needs is it fulfilling? Like, clearly there's a financial need for both workers and employers, and there is a social contract there. But there is also a social relationship. There are social needs that, you know, when you think about your identity at work, that's also a big part of your identity and your self-confidence, for instance. Like, you feel you belong somewhere. And that's what we clearly saw in the case of the garment factory, which was very embedded in a particular region in Manchester of blue collar workers, and a lot of workers lived nearby the factory. And yeah, thinking about, you know, how do you identify or relate to your work? And, you know, perhaps there is something that changed where we now see kind of the unintended consequences of, in terms of, you know, that people are less satisfied, or that they so feel that, you know, their work is being measured, is being controlled, that it kind of has a counter effect. All areas for future research, I would say. Yeah, things to think about. And also for managers to think about, like, you know, is there perhaps something that we need to change in the way we control workers that makes work more appealing to them, more satisfying?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And some of these workplaces that we're talking about are places that are generally not the sort of job that, you know, people would ordinarily gravitate towards. Factory work is very difficult. It is on site. You know, anything that really you can't do remotely, that really requires on site, is one that I would imagine management really does have to be creative in trying to show the value of doing it, because blue collar is traditionally not paid as much. I've heard this a couple of times in different settings where we have, say, a factory, one was an aircraft factory, and they basically made a public lament. I don't need more engineers going to college. I need more welders. And they're willing to pay, pre-pandemic, by the way, so I can only imagine how it's gotten worse. But, you know, welding, high-skilled welding is actually a really good kind of paying job, and it's also pretty stable, and it's also career-enhancing. I mean, you can make those types of trade skills into a career nowadays. But because of some sort of changes in expectations as far as when we enter the workforce, what we're expecting from it may have shifted to the point where, yeah, even with those incentives, it just hasn't been enough to draw people out of this mindset of going to college, for example, of credentialing with degrees and back into the trades.
Yeah, definitely. And perhaps what we see now is that, you know, the initiatives of workers to reskill themselves and find better jobs is more than it has ever been, perhaps. You know, this is just some thinking on the spot of me here, like I don't have any data on this, but the fact that so many industries are facing labor shortages, like, you know, these people didn't just disappear. Like, clearly they are making a livelihood by working, and they need to work to make a living, but they found another way. And perhaps, you know, with the rise of the internet, with online education becoming more accessible, also the threats of automation that we have made people anxious about losing their jobs in the future, and the pandemic and their furloughs and being laid off being a first warning for them. Perhaps they have thought, like, you know, I need to do something, and using the pandemic to reskill themselves and find better jobs. It might not just be better paying jobs, because clearly, you know, the financial part is an issue here. If we would increase the salaries, I'm sure there are more people willing to do the types of work where we see labor shortages now. But also finding better workplaces that, you know, when we are at work, it's a nicer place to be. It's meeting our other needs of, you know, what work means to us.
I think perhaps one of the things that I feel is missing, or I'm interested in the two case studies, is potentially just understanding in a longer time span where the workers went afterwards. Because I think, obviously, they're both restricted to around about 6 months, which is a fair amount of time where a lot of things can happen, but it is not enough to see other interesting aspects, which might be, were these people there for a certain amount of time because they actually aspired or were given or knew that they had the opportunity to progress? Or were they actually just waiting for a better opportunity? And I think those are important things that probably within 6 months, there is not enough time to capture them. That's one thing that I would put as a point, probably a limitation of the study, as we know. The other thing that connecting back to sort of modern up-to-date debates is around, again, the meaning of work, but the meaning of work in relation to other things that are happening in your life, in particular hobbies, passions, interests. And I think that is something that wasn't within the focus of the study, but say these studies or something similar were to happen today, I think it would be something important. So what I've been reading around is this idea that to work well, to be happy at work, you actually need a hobby, a passion that drives you. And I think, I can't remember where I read it, but I found that an interesting concept in terms of aspirations, how it's not all work, but it's that driving nature of a passion that you may not actually be that great at. It might not be something that pays the bill, but still you deeply enjoy. And that is the thing that actually counteracts as a force to the work, to the workplace.
Excellent point. And I always go back to our episode we did on Kunda. It was management control gone amok. And basically, the whole work-life balance just did not exist. And the company, the organizational culture was such that it didn't want balance to exist. It wanted total commitment of its workers to the exclusion of their private lives. And I think that, whether or not it's actually true, the mythology associated with management is out to get you or is out to control you is kind of out there enough. I think that, it still kind of drives a lot of people in terms of their decisions as to whether or not they wanted to return to the workplace. Because I think that some of this is driving a lot of the focus on toxic leadership, destructive leadership. It comes under many names nowadays. But every day on my iPhone, I get one of these social media dumps where they say, 30 examples of bad management, or managers abusing workers and stuff like that. There's a lot of this, managers are just bad people and you deserve better kind of trope that it's going to be really, really hard to overcome if we want to change or alter or address the issue of the meaning of work. If everybody believes that going back to work is going to be unnecessarily painful, nobody's going to want to do it.
Yeah, and I think all these points are even more true for when your manager is an algorithm or a robot, which is a reality for many workers today. And even if it's not a robot or an algorithm, like the quantification of control, the feeling of being controlled, being under constant scrutiny, and all the systems that are being implemented to, check productivity and the quantification of your outputs, that opens up a whole conversation about what values go into management and what do you optimize for. And perhaps, some of the values of, worker well-being, worker happiness, all components that are needed for resilience, sustainability of workflow dynamics, perhaps not getting enough attention or being overshadowed by, the pressures put on firms by globalization, by the pandemic, and, perhaps also the stock market at the moment.
Yeah, and the challenge is we have this conversation is how important it is to also consider the manager's perspective. Management may be due for a transformation. What does it mean to manage people? Because, you think about some of the things that are coming out in these discussions, particularly when it comes to workers who have significant family concerns, some of it caused by long COVID or brought about by the pandemic. I think part of the issue with management control is sort of it's still remnants of a very old mindset that the worker is the individual worker and everything else is superfluous. Whereas nowadays, there's expectations or there's demands that the entire worker is sort of accepted and accommodated in the workforce. I don't know if that makes sense, but it seems to be part of where the conversation is going. And I don't know to what extent management is equipped to deal with that, along with the usual pressures that management is always under.
Yeah, and another, important question we need to ask is, how is work being experienced outside of organizations when it happens in markets where you don't have a manager, you're your own manager? When you're self-employed, you're working as a contractor, control is exercised through digital platforms, for instance, digital labor platforms. How do these people experience work? And how are these interests of efficiency and productivity balanced with social needs? I would love to hear more and read more about that.
Well, I'll give you a present example that I've seen not too long ago on with respect to the YouTube platform. One of the things that's, phenomena that has happened in recent years has been the rise of, YouTube channels and individuals who basically establish their channel and that becomes their job. And there's been growing pressures placed on platforms to exercise some kind of control over YouTubers. One front is in intellectual property and copyright abuses because people are including in their channels copyrighted contact without proper authority or permissions and things like that. And then you have others where YouTubers start to delve into controversial topics because controversy is part of what makes some channels hum. And then the platform is under pressure to try to put a rein on some of the levels of controversy and things like that. You know, it's, I think there's sort of a pendulum swing, but it's swinging at different points in time, depending on the industry. You know, places where perhaps the individual autonomy has become, you know, there's been like sanctuaries where that's been encouraged. Now we're starting to see the pendulum kind of swing back that controls, you know, it's like the constant paradox between control and flexibility or control and autonomy. It's ever present. It's always going to be present. It's going to manifest in new and interesting ways, I suppose. But it's an ongoing conversation. So in here, it's like, okay, you may be able to decide you want to break away from one context in order to get away from what's bad about that one. But eventually, your new context is not necessarily going to be a utopia either. There was a freshness and newness associated with online channels and things of that nature, but the system is trying to catch up to it now.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the takeaways from this study that I got from reading the book is we really have to understand what the work is about to understand how we can strike a balance between, you know, this autonomy versus control, the interest of management versus the interest of the workers. The balance in one workplace might not be the balance that is good in another workplace. So yeah, that was one of my takeaway of reading the book.
I think if I can add to Greta's lovely takeaways, I would also start thinking about being able to really get an in-depth observation and even experience and a proper sort of feel for the work to then be able to draw some conclusions or some findings and properly kind of give that story and take it to life, which I feel that sometimes we try to do. Some research methods are more prone to it and have more opportunities, some don't. But it's always something important that as scholars, we kind of bear in mind the importance of bringing those stories to life.
And I guess my last takeaway is that Lupton's study deserves a lot more attention than it has gotten. It has proven to really shed a lot of light on worker management relations and the social systems that help workers sort of, you know, bound together or not and try to protect themselves against some of the controls imposed upon them by management. It's very relevant and can inform a lot about some of the contemporary issues that we presently face in work. And it's just kind of a shame that it hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. We hope that this episode helped rectify that situation.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.